Hello and welcome to Relatable. This is your host, Teresa Freeman. A quick reminder for everyone that we have Relatable on the Go episodes on the TFA Soft Skills YouTube channel. Check out our condensed video interviews there. All of the on the go segments are 15 minutes or less. You can find us by typing TFA Soft Skills in the YouTube channel search bar. In this special episode of Relatable, I speak with Lisa Kersey, a dear friend and the executive director of FreeKind, an anti-human trafficking nonprofit organization in Virginia. Their mission? To prevent human trafficking in their Southern Virginia community and support the survivors throughout their journey to freedom. You will be surprised at how pervasive this is in the U.S. and how it is most likely happening in communities in which you know the people involved. Lisa also shares her career journey from healthcare administration to working as an executive director in the nonprofit world. I learned so much throughout this interview, and I'm sure you will as well. Enjoy this discussion. Awesome. All right. Let's talk there. Okay. So we're going to start. I'm speaking with Miss Lisa Kersey, or not Kersey. Are you still Kersey? Yeah. You're right. Okay. Lisa and I have known each other a long time. So, but we haven't really had an in-depth conversation about what you're doing and, you know, what really led you to this path. So I'm really excited to talk with you. And I think what you're doing is pretty amazing and has a huge impact. So I'm one excited to get more information out about what you're doing and to the extent that Relatable can help do that. And we can, you know, be a platform for that. I'm excited to do, but also just from an education standpoint. And, you know, obviously you've been immersed in this world for a while now. So you probably have a lot of information that you can share or ways that we can talk about it that helps people to understand it better and what we can do to help, you know, in terms of solving the issue. So tell us a little bit about, and now that I've teed it up so mysteriously, tell us a little bit about what you do, what you're affiliated with, and kind of your mission.
Great. Thank you so much for having me talk about this. I'm excited, but I can talk about it all day. So you will have to like redirect and cut me off now and again.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
All right.
Stay on track. So yeah, my organization is called FreeKind, and it is an anti-human trafficking nonprofit based right here in Virginia. Our mission is pretty straightforward. It's to prevent human trafficking in our communities and to support survivors as they are on their journey to freedom. And that sounds maybe to some like it's kind of pie in the sky, unless you don't know that it's happening here in our country, in our state, in our communities. Yeah. And a lot of people, like I did, learned about it at first as something that happened somewhere else. You know, I was concerned about the child soldiers and the kids being caught up in that kind of thing in other countries. But the more you look into it and over the years, I don't know that it's how much has truly increased versus our awareness of it happening mm-hmm. has been increased over the last, I would say, you know, 5 to 10 years in particular. So that's who we are and that's what we do.
And how long have you been working with that organization?
Well, I started actually as a volunteer with the organization because I learned about the issue and wanted to do something. I was still in my other career. And then I was asked to be on the board. And then when the previous executive director stepped down, I was asked to step in as interim. And that's all I was planning on doing. And that was January of 2020. Okay. And here we are, February of 2024. And I'm still here.
All right. So I do want to dig in a bit more to the content of what you're doing and how you're doing it for the purpose of the, mm-hmm. from a career perspective and talking about as an executive director of a nonprofit. Can you talk a little bit about what that role is like? What are the things that you have to do in that role for a nonprofit? And I think for the purpose of, education. People generally know the difference between for-profit and nonprofit, but maybe just a little bit about that too could be helpful.
Sure. So a nonprofit versus a for-profit. In the nonprofit world, you have a mission statement and your responsibility is to the community. Yeah. Because you're a nonprofit. We happen to be a 501c3 tax exempt. So yes, that comes with responsibility. We do and are required to have a board of directors, and they are ultimately accountable for what this organization does and how the money is spent in the organization. So it's pretty serious level of responsibility. But in the for-profit world, obviously, your goal is generally more to make the profit, and you answer to your stakeholders who are primarily investors. And so it's a different mindset on what you're, what you're trying to achieve and who you're ultimately accountable to.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the basic difference. Even though I worked in the corporate world, I worked in healthcare most of my career. And so those were large health systems. They were nonprofit, but because we did do a lot of charity work and things like that, but it functioned more like any other corporate, entity that you work in. Nonprofit is very different, and depending on the size of the nonprofit. So keep that in mind, because some people know about groups like, the American Red Cross or Habitat for Humanity or something like that. Those are very large organizations that, though they are nonprofit, they also probably function a little bit more like a corporate entity, though, again, they still are, they still do answer to the community. In my nonprofit, which is a little bit smaller, so we are, still under $1 million. We have six, full-time staff members, small. But when you hear what we do, you're going to wonder how we do that with such a small staff. I wonder that on a daily basis. But when you're in a smaller nonprofit or even a medium-sized nonprofit, you're all often going to wear many hats. So for me in this role, I am the executive director, so like the CEO of an organization. So I have oversight for everything and responsibility for everything that happens, all of our programs. I'm coaching people and I supervise people directly. So I have sort of more of that director or managerial role. I am, you're looking at the fundraising, lead fundraiser for our organization. We are working towards hiring a development director, but right now that's me. And so that includes grant writing and going out and networking with people and meeting with other corporations and nonprofits and trying to get people to understand our mission and want to, come alongside that. I work on contracts and memorandums of understanding. I wear the HR hat. I'm the director of marketing, although I do luckily have a marketing and social media manager. So that is helpful. But you can hear all those hats and you can imagine how a day looks. So it's kind of funny when you say, what's a typical day? I'm not sure there is one. It's some mix of those. And on any given day, it's more of one than the other.
Yeah. And then tell me a little bit about the transition from being in the corporate side and being, I think, you were part of the health administration and so healthcare administration. So tell me about the move. And then I think, what were some of your considerations or how much of a risk was it for you to leave the security of that to do this? Tell me a little bit about that move. And then I'd like to talk more about the actual work that you all are doing.
Yeah, great. So, early on in my life, my parents were older and I had a lot of experience with healthcare and hospitals. I did even in my hometown volunteer for our children's hospital, which at that time we were called Candy Stripers. I don't know if they still call them that or not. That's how old I am. But so I had early exposure to that and really had a heart for that work. And that's what led me into doing the healthcare administration piece. It was learning about the issue of human trafficking, like literally through a documentary. Like nothing happened to me personally. It didn't happen to somebody I knew. But like I said, when I first learned about it, it's something that happened over there and then kept researching and was learning that, no, it's happening here. It's happening to people in our country, citizens of this country. It's not, I'm not saying this doesn't happen, but it's not primarily people being taken from our country somewhere else. And it's not primarily people brought into our country and exploited. It's people who live in your neighborhood, who live in your city, work with you, go to school with you, who this is happening to. And so it just pierced me. And I thought, I got to do something about this. And I don't know what that is. And I don't know if that means that's my next career move or I'm supposed to do something else. So I just kept researching. I would schedule meetings with people. I would meet who were in the space to ask them questions and had some really fortunate meetings in that regard for people to say, there are so many ways you can help in this. Tell me a little bit more about what's drawing you to this and what is it? Is it your, you know, you have to look at your skill sets, but also what is the deep-seated thing in me that cares so much about this topic? And I've always had a very deep-seated sense of justice, and that was completely unjust for me. And the thought of somebody buying and selling somebody else for profit in 2024 in our country is like, I can't stand it. I would not be able to sleep at night if I weren't doing something about it. So I thought that it might be my next job. And so I was looking at things and nothing was lining up. So then I thought, well, maybe I can volunteer somewhere. And then I stumbled upon this organization and that I now work for, and just started volunteering for the organization. And so it wasn't as much of an intentional shift from being in healthcare administration to being a nonprofit manager, but it was the issue for me that said, I've got to make this shift. And honestly, at this stage of my life and my career, I said I would step in as interim, and they said, do you want to be considered for the permanent position? And I said, absolutely not, because I recognized that it was a large responsibility to take on at that time, you know, even, you know, smaller. When I took it on, we had, I think, 3.5 employees, and we were hovering at, you know, $150,000, $200,000. Like, it was just a smaller organization, and we needed to shift from being a smaller organization that was just trying to get people to understand that it was happening in our community, which is how the executive director started it. And he was an attorney by trade, so he's also working on a lot of legislation. Legislation takes on a life of its own. It involves lobbying. And so we had decided that that needed to be separated anyway. So he continues to do that work, which is great and needed. And we sort of solidified who we were in this space. Like, what unique role did we play? Because it takes a community. There's no one person or organization that can do everything it takes in this space. And we needed to really say, what are we doing that maybe nobody else is doing that is adding value to this movement in Virginia? And for us, we were able to define that when I came over. And then, you know, from the time that that happened, well, really, let's be honest, COVID hit. So there was that. And in some ways, that sort of ushered in the, yes, I'll take this on because I have a lot of history with the organization as a volunteer, and I want to get us through this season, which first we thought was going to be a few months, and you know how that went. So it's a miracle. It really is in a lot of ways. So yeah, so that's how really the shift happened for me.
Let's talk a little bit about, so you mentioned the state of Virginia. So that is that your focus in terms of your organization? It's all based on the state of Virginia in terms of when you talk about community and doing something like this. So is the answer to that yes? Like, are you focused solely in the state of Virginia?
Well, it's a hybrid answer. So there are three programs in our organization that help us fulfill the mission that I mentioned earlier. One is just awareness, and we do a lot of industry specific training because different industries are going to have different opportunities to see and disrupt it, right? So healthcare, social workers, law enforcement, anybody along the criminal legal continuum, hospitality, transportation, you know, they all have slightly different roles that they can play. So we are out there a lot just continuing to raise awareness. And even though I've been doing this now for, what is this, beginning of my fifth year in this role and having volunteered for 3 years before that, it still never fails that I'm going to talk to somebody who says, wait a minute, you mean it's happening here? So, you know, there's still a lot of people who don't know that it's happening here, or what it looks like, who it happens to, who the traffickers are. And we can talk more about that later. But, you know, our work on the survivor side of what we do, the direct survivor support, that's hard to do with any distance. So that is specific to Virginia. And right now it is specifically in the Hampton Roads area. And we are expanding some of our services up into the Richmond community. There are other partners in both of those markets that play other roles. And again, we'll talk about that in a bit. But that's kind of where our survivor work is. And then there's a prevention side of what we do. So one of the things that we know, and there's no, sadly, there's a dearth of data really on this issue. There are a lot of studies out there, but it's not the kind of issue or crime that there's any centralized database or something that you can truly, you know, extrapolate from. But there have been a lot of studies done in certain aspects of trafficking. And so one of the studies that we talk about a lot is that the Polaris Project did, and they're the ones who run the National Human Trafficking Hotline. And they found in this particular study that the victims of trafficking The 83% of the victims of trafficking had said that their trafficking began between the age of 11 and 23. And then working with survivors, we know that while not all of them had their trafficking begin then, a lot of them had adverse childhood experiences and, you know, some sort of abuse in, you know, in the home, or were exposed to some sort of violence, even if it wasn't directly to them. And those things open up vulnerabilities in people that can lead to them being an easy target for a trafficker. And so because of that, we are just as committed to preventing the next generation from being trafficked as we are helping those who have already experienced that kind of exploitation. And there was an organization based in Richmond, another nonprofit, that actually created the curriculum that we work to get into middle schools and high schools. And they reached out to us in 2021 and said, how would you like to merge? And so we were focused on survivors at the time. They were focused on prevention. And now FreeKind is doing both ends of the spectrum.
Okay. All right. Now, it's interesting when you talk about 11 to 23, that's a pretty wide range. And for me, as I'm listening to you, I even think about those that are older. You think, how does someone who's older, that probably has a little bit more agency than like 11-year-old, you know, you think of a 23-year-old. So tell me a little bit about, for those of us that aren't as familiar, what does it look like? You know, I mean, what is it, what is happening? What is the actual, when we talk about trafficking, what does that mean exactly?
Relatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, your one-stop shop for workshops, coaching, speaking, and soft skills development. If you'd like to hire Teresa, visit www.tfasoftskills.com for more information.
Yeah, by federal definition, human trafficking involves force, fraud, or coercion for the purpose of sex or labor, primarily. There's also organ trafficking, but usually we're talking about labor or sex. What we share with people is that, yes, that is the federal definition, but the reality is, at its core, human trafficking is the exploitation of somebody else's vulnerability. That's really what it is. And in our country, it doesn't, you know, it looks different in different countries. It looks different in different states, even in communities sometimes. But in our country, the majority of human trafficking happens in the context of families and intimate partner relationships, which makes it really hard to see for the person being exploited as well as for those around them. So it's not like in some third world countries where kids, and this, you know, is awful, but will grow up knowing that that's like their duty to their family because there's so much poverty. That is not happening. And people buy and sell, you know, in plain sight and nobody says a thing. That is not normalized in our country, but some of the behaviors that can influence and lead to it are normalized in our country, but it's not that blatant, right? So that's why it's harder, like I said, that's why it's harder to see in our country. And it happens, you know, most traffickers will play the long game. So we call it in our industry grooming. So they will identify somebody. And again, it's somebody with a vulnerability. They're going to spend some time getting to know you. It might feel like a relationship. It's often somebody maybe that you, like for younger kids, they might meet them at a party and they go to a different school and maybe they're just a little bit older. And so, no, you know, people don't know them who you know well. So it can happen that way. It can happen again, though, because in these circles that they create, it is most of the time somebody that you know. So even, yes, if you didn't initially know them and you become, you know, come in relationship with them, they're building that relationship to learn about you, to learn what your hopes and dreams are, to learn what your vulnerabilities are, you know, kind of what makes you tick. And then they slowly start to use that to expand your boundaries, right? To get you to do things that, you know, maybe a year ago you wouldn't have done, but now you're in a relationship with this person and you sort of rationalize some of it in your mind. And maybe agree to do things that you wouldn't normally agree to do. because they make it sound like it's for you or for you as a couple. Or maybe, you know, I'm having financial issues. Maybe I came from a single parent family and I share at some point in there that, you know, my mom just lost her job. And you're like, oh, I have this uncle and, you know, he's just a really great businessman. And let me introduce him you to him and he can help you. And that help often comes in the form of exploitation. And so that's kind of more how it looks like. It doesn't look like I said, normalized in other countries. And it's not the, you know, the white van that drives up and kidnaps kids. Like, I'm not saying that never happens, but I need people to understand that that is not primarily how it happens. Most victims of trafficking know their trafficker, adults and children. Mm-hmm. They know their trafficker. So in the younger years, it looks like that. In college, it has some unique nuances. So think about college. If you're going away to college, you might be away from home for the first time. So you're in a new place. You don't really know the scene. You know, your brain's not fully developed. I'm not saying that. The neuroscientists tell us that, right? That's right. Not fully formed until our 20s. And so you're still, you don't have your full executive function. You're kind of wide-eyed looking to see what's going to happen in your life in the next 4 years. You're looking for friends and excitement, and you're looking to see if you can find somebody to be in a relationship with, you know, that, you know, that maybe you're going to fall in love with. You're looking for, trying to figure out, like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? What do I want to do? I don't even know where to start. You know, so you have all these questions and you're at this transition point in your life that makes you very vulnerable mm-hmm. to people who want to take advantage of that. So one of the things that we know is happening in colleges and universities is something called sugar dating. Now, back when we were young, you would sometimes, even we would jokingly talk about, oh, that's my sugar daddy. You know, just if it was truly your boyfriend, or maybe you were referring to your own parent or an uncle or whoever, right? And we meant it jokingly. We didn't realize that there was something more to that term. So I don't use that anymore as a joke, because that's exactly what's happening. So there are some sites out there that look like they're just dating apps, which have become very, you know, prolific in this generation, the whole digital age, of course, and we'll come back to that in a moment. So much of it in our country too happens online like that. So it looks like a dating site, but most of the people who sign up for it are older men. And then they are targeting college age people to also join the site. And it's this idea that it's just companionship. I just want to be able to take somebody to dinner. I want to be able to go to the movies with somebody, whatever. And we know that they've targeted college kids, if for no other reason, that one of their campaigns was, we will give you free premium access if you use your school address. That doesn't tell you that they were targeting college age kids. Yeah. I'm not sure what does. And then some of the images on the site weren't necessarily of happy looking couples. They were, it was a meter showing the cost of college and how this was going to help you pay for college.
Right. It's incentivizing. What? And when you talk about this too, is it co-ed? You know, I think of it mostly being women and young girls, and maybe that's predominantly true, but I suspect there's, you know, young boys and maybe adult males that are involved that on a trafficking perspective.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Yep. On the sugar dating site, there certainly is, there are both, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but that's a really good question. And yes, it can happen to anybody. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, your race, your socioeconomics, your sexual identity, your...
And I think as you're talking, just to, I just want to make sure, like, I don't know if other people that are listening to this are kind of thinking this way, but I think about there's a lot of discussion about sexual abuse, right? From like similarly or like people, you know, or, you know, people that, you know, it comes out years later that it was an uncle or a coach or right. So to me, what you're describing with respect to that familiarity and community, this is similar. And then it's taking it like a step further, which is now I'm not just abusing you, but now I'm trafficking you, right? Like I'm abusing you probably and selling you or getting some sort of monetization off of you in some capacity. Is that, so it's like, take your sexual abuse, which maybe is a little bit more common knowledge, and then like, you know, that then the next step to that, which is then to get some sort of income or something more out of that abuse.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. So That's exactly right. And there's what we call a survivor leader. So somebody who is a survivor herself and is now a leader in the industry trying to help work against it. Her name's Rebecca Bender, and she grew up in a rural town in Oregon. And she ended up, right before she was headed to college, she got pregnant by her boyfriend. And she was trying to decide, do I, you know, not keep this child and move on to college, or do I keep this child? And then how does that, you know, change things? And so she decided to keep the child. And then she got invited to live with some friends who were going to college, so she could still be with her people. And she was going to raise her daughter, and she was going to, you know, get back on the path to working. And in the course of doing that, she met a guy, and he was just everything she thought she wanted. And he seemed to love her daughter. And she was really excited about that relationship. And she often says in some of her talks about, you know, they say when somebody takes your child by the hand, they take the mother by the heart. And she said that's kind of what happened to her. And the guy said, you know, I'm in, and I can't remember what it was now, like in the entertainment industry, and I can make a lot more money in Vegas, and I have some contacts out there. So why don't we move out there? They had moved in together. Why don't we move there? And so she agrees to do this. So they get there. And for her, now she had been in this relationship with this guy for, you know, 9 months or a year. They had been living together. He was so good to her and to her daughter, moved them out there. And it flipped pretty quickly, right? Because what has he done? He's moved her out of her comfort zone, away from everybody she knows, away from a familiar area. She's still this single mom trying to figure out what her next plan is. And he says, basically, it was really expensive for me to move you here, and you're going to have to help. And literally took her to a place that was essentially an escort service and said, go in here and, you know, do what they tell you to do. And so she started to do that. And at one point she says to people, you know, I was raised in this country. I see the movies and all of that stuff too. She said, but I would have described myself at one point as a prostitute with a boyfriend who beat me. That's how she perceived it. So when you think of prostitution, most people think of that as something that is a choice, right? I chose to do that.
Right.
Which is what traffickers get people to believe, that they chose to do this. I'm not going to tell you that there's nobody in the country who chooses to do that, but it is a very, very, very slim number. And most of the research that's been done, and certainly every client that we've worked with, it is not their chosen profession. And even if they did it for a while on their own, as they got older, and maybe their trafficker did go to jail or something, and they started doing it on their own and being able to keep their own money, it took them a minute to realize, like, oh, but wait, this is still not what I want to be doing. And, you know, I'm basically now trafficking myself. So most people do not choose to do it. But that's how she thought of herself. And then, you know, only later realized with a lot of people trying, a family who cared about her but didn't have a lot of means necessarily to help, who was always, you know, looking for her, tracking her down, inviting her to come back home, all of that. Not everybody has that. And then the shame and the guilt moved all the way down this path, and I feel like there's no return. I might not even be willing or wanting to go back to people, even if they do love me and want to help me, right?
Right.
Because I feel like it was my fault and that I've done this shameful thing. And the traffickers work hard to do that. So after that initial grooming to get you to a place to do things that you don't want to do, then it becomes more isolation, more exploitation. And sometimes the direct person can remain, I don't know how to say this, like nice to you, if you want to put it that way. And they're kind of plays the, you know, the tough, meaner guy. And then people often ask, like, but why do people stick, you know? And it's not primarily that they're literally locked in rooms. And again, I'm not going to say that that never happens, but it is not primarily the chains that hold trafficking victims in place, if you will, are all mental and emotional. And like I said, they've gotten into a relationship with this person, so it's become kind of a complex situation. I think I love them even though they're exploiting me, but they told me it was for us.
I mean, so the thing that I think that's interesting as you talk about this, and you talk about this question of staying and how can people stay in it, I think of it like to try to relate to it. We all have this capacity, I think, to succumb to things that aren't necessarily the ideal or the, you know, you might be in a situation where for months you're not leaving your house and you're binge watching TV or you're drinking too much or you're eating too much or you're pick your thing that we, that I think anyone can relate to of a behavior or a lifestyle that you don't necessarily want to be in. But because of the, to your point, the mental, the emotional, whatever those external, maybe they're external factors, maybe they're internal factors, you know, there's, this is such a provocative, obviously, and dramatic situation that people are in. And maybe to your point, there's not as much visibility into it. And so there's, it's happening more than we think. So I think people think, oh, mentally, how do I wrap my head around it? But I think as you're talking to me, it's like, oh, it's just, you know, it's another fact, another branch of this kind of behavior where we get ourselves into situations that we don't necessarily want to be in because of a, you know, we sadly don't have hours and hours to talk about this from a, an education perspective, or even more like if we were to kind of take some salient points here with respect to saying no, or helping to educate people, or how do people, depending on their age, you know, what are some of the things you can share based on your involvement here that have worked for people either to get out of it, or maybe mm-hmm. even getting into it in the first, maybe start there first, like getting into it in the first place, how can you know that to resist it? But then we'll talk about maybe if you're older, getting out of it.
Yeah. So the first part is a lot of what we do in our prevention program, mm-hmm. which is we teach about self-worth and mm-hmm. self-confidence, human dignity of people. We talk about healthy boundaries and healthy relationships, which is huge. I prefer even talking about healthy boundaries versus giving consent, because especially for minors, somebody can make me believe I gave consent. Like, so it's not that, it's a healthy boundary. Like the, you can say no, no matter who it is to something that mm-hmm. makes you uncomfortable. And knowing that, you know, making sure you have a safe person in your life, whoever that might be, that you, if something does happen, you can say something and that you don't have to hold on to that yourself, because that's a big part of it. Again, that isolation, that shame. And if I don't tell anybody, then that person, and that person often uses the threats and things like that, you know, and I don't want to say that they're not sincere threats, but, you know, it's always better to try to tell somebody than not, and not to allow yourself to be isolated, because that is, you know, that is a, that, that creates that vulnerability for people. Knowing healthy online, you know, safety, you know, it's just so, you know, the internet and social and all that is just so ubiquitous. And people, you know, kids who grew up in this generation, you know, came out of the womb on, you know, pressing mm-hmm. buttons for things. It's so second nature. And old people like me, they're like, ah, oh, what is she talking about? You know, it's fine. I'm not saying don't use those things. I'm saying that know what you're doing when you do use them, and yeah. take a few precautions on the things that you, you know, some boundaries you'll set for that, so that you don't put yourself in a dangerous situation. Because anything out there these days with a chat room, or anything like that, so anything from gaming platforms yeah. to social media, the new app of the day, and dating apps, all of those are places where you're sharing information or talking to people, yeah. and you can, without even realizing it sometimes, start to disclose things that make you a target.
It's so interesting. I feel like it's an important little anecdote here. My when people that listen to this regularly know about Paul and know about him being sick. And so when he was mm-hmm. sick, and we were, it was kind of the height of it, and I was at Johns Hopkins and I wasn't here, my sister came to stay with my boys. And so this was, gosh, like 3 years ago now. So, or 2 years ago. So my youngest was 12, I guess. And he was gaming a lot. And I think it was COVID. And so, you know, they were all like, you know, that was how they're connecting. But my sister just happened to hear him, and it sounded different than like someone that he knew. She just happened, mm-hmm. she, you know, she wasn't even acutely listening for it, but she ended up talking right. to him about it. And it was like some older brother of a person, like it was not right. And she was like, no, no. Like we only talk to people we know. And like the, it was such a fleeting thing. And mm-hmm. it was an education moment, and a, you know, and she knew that we had said like, you can't game with people you don't know, or, you know, but this idea of like, I think, you know, being aware, and being aware enough that even as parents, where you have a very safe community, and you, you know, you think you spend time with your kids and you know your kids and you know what they're doing, the whole digital aspect of this is tricky and hard to manage, for sure.
Yes. Yes. And the one thing we caution, and not just us, but like the FBI cautions parents, is don't threaten to take away your child's technology. Like, that's not going to solve it. And in fact, that's going to make them never come to you when something does happen.
Yeah.
It is about having the conversations just like your sister did. And it's about having them before you might even overhear something.
Yeah.
There are some really great documentaries out there. One of them I highly recommend is called Childhood 2.0.
Okay.
It's like 90 minutes. So it you know, you're going to need to sit a minute with it. But it's a fascinating look for parents and caregivers, especially into how the digital age has changed the world, and how with those of us that didn't grow up with that, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And so learning more about that and what our young people are actually facing is really critical to you being able to have any kind of conversation that will help you and help them understand, you know, how it's being misused. They want to, you know, they want a sense of belonging, and they want to connect with people. That's common to all of our humanity, right? Mm-hmm. But that sense of belonging is what actually trips up so many people into being trafficked.
And honestly, you think about... Now that you're saying that 11 to 23 and that the idea of you're so vulnerable in terms of your peer group and wanting acceptance and feeling like everybody's watching. And so all you just need that one person to fill that vulnerability or to fill that exposure and say you're all the things that you want other people to think that you are. And then you put your trust in that person. It feels like it's such a recipe, right? Or it's like you're ripe for the taking, for sure. And then what about when you're older? So if you're older and you're in this scenario in terms of, you know, tell us some tips there in terms of ways to maybe to get out of that.
Teresa's new book, Soft Skills I Learned the Hard Way, is out and available on Amazon. She writes about many epic fails throughout her career and how she learned from them, so you don't have to. This book is full of cheat codes for how you can differentiate yourself when it matters, like in interviews, trying to get a promotion, or being a first-time leader. As always, thank you, Relatable Community. We are so grateful for your support and continued listenership. As of today, we are 10,000 listeners strong. Now back to the show.
So what's interesting about that, because like I said, most of the people in it wouldn't call themselves victims, right? So part of the work that FreeKind does is we go into the jails and we teach a class, because most victims actually end up spending some jail time in the course of their abuse. And that's because their trafficker sort of adds, I call it insult to injury part of trafficking, where they are not only trafficking you, which is bad enough, but they will have you do things to keep themselves at arm's length that you could get in trouble for, such as drug possession, fraud, giving a false name to a law enforcement officer, signing off on, you know, loans or leases or those kinds of things. They will also ruin your credit that way. On purpose, because all of those things make them at arm's length
dependent.
And they make you, it makes it harder for you to leave because they've often also taken your identification documents. So if I don't have my ID to tell, you know, to say this is who I am, if I don't know where I am, if they've moved me, if I have this gap in work history or maybe never worked, if I am afraid to go back home or don't have a home anymore for whatever reason, like all of those things, it's like, well, the fear of what am I gonna do keeps people there too. And a desire, because most of us have we've all experienced this. So think of like your darkest moment. And the one thing you have is hope sometimes to hold on to, hope that it's gonna get better. Hope that this season is too gonna pass. And that's true for people in trafficking until they are so dehumanized by their trafficker that they have managed to somehow strip them even of that. But that little hope is what keeps a lot of them going long enough to then intersect with somebody who can actually help. So somebody who can actually help could be any of us, right? Mm-hmm. If we know about it, It can be the whole criminal legal system, which is why we spend a lot of our time and focus on working and training and talking and building relationships with them. Because the sooner somebody gets identified, the sooner they can get help, and they're not going to keep cycling in and out of jail, which is what happens. So it's going to take something to make them realize that what's happening to them is, you know, is a crime, and that this person doesn't truly love them or care about them in some way. So that class that we do in the jails, I mean, it's a lot of the same thing, but on the level of an adult, that we do for our middle and high schoolers, where we teach them about healthy relationships and healthy boundaries, this thing called trafficking and what it looks like and how it happens. And you just see like light bulbs go off for people realizing for the first time what's happened to them. So short of having somebody intervene, I don't know how they get out of it. Some, it's going to sound awful, but like there are intersections too. So there's intersections with domestic violence. So sometimes it's, you know, the husband trafficking his wife. Sometimes it's a mother trafficking her daughter. People get shocked by that because they think when it's a parent that it must be the dad. But that's not primarily the case. And part of that is because there are a ton of single moms out there in the world. And if any of them end up in addiction that has gotten so bad, and we've had many clients that this is their story, so this is a real thing. I'm not just saying, well, this could happen. This does happen where their addiction is so deep that they will sell their own child. And so when that is what's happened to you at some point in your life, that makes you more vulnerable than being an adult. And it makes it harder for you to see and get out without something like a class like ours, or a law enforcement officer who recognizes the signs, or a friend who says, you know, can I meet your new boyfriend? you know, who asks a few questions. Yeah. That's what it takes. They rarely get out, quote unquote, on their own. Some of them win if a trafficker finally gets prosecuted, which is really hard to do. It's a hard case to build oftentimes because they've taken such care to not allow it to be built. I don't want to say that none of them are prosecuted. They absolutely are. But when that happens and they're away from their trafficker, sometimes that gives people the out that they needed. Or in the case of somebody who's become a friend of mine who is a survivor herself, she thought she was dying that particular night. And this trafficker like literally dumped her in this empty parking lot. But it was a police officer who happened to drive by and ask her what she was doing out there. And recognized that as he had a conversation and treated her like a human being who may was not there by choice. That's the difference, because also the traffickers have taught them that law enforcement isn't their friend. They shouldn't trust law enforcement. And if they're treated by people who, if law enforcement believes that people who prostitute are out there by choice, they tend to treat them not as people.
Right.
I'm sad to say that. That's not true of a lot of them, and a lot more. There's a lot more learning out there now, but there are plenty who still kind of have that mindset that they chose to be there. Or I'm trying to get to this conviction, you know, this drug conviction. And so I use you to get what I need for that without care that you're a victim who's been, you are the evidence in that case, you know, versus the drugs or the guns that I can see right in front of me.
One of the things as you're talking, just as you're talking about the older people involved in this in terms of it, I think it translates then to the next question, obvious question around what can we do, people that are listening to this and people that maybe aren't as engaged or now they're learning about something that they want to help. So in terms of what can people do, and it sounds based on everything you're telling me, like education is such a big piece of this, just both on the part of those of us that maybe want to help and don't know how, or just the education around getting it in front of people. So what are the ways people can engage and help too?
There are so many ways, and you do not have to have any special skills to help. You really don't. One is, being educated. There's tons, again, in this digital age, we've got great information we can access, and there's misinformation. Yeah. So, you know, I recommend that you go, and we have a list of them. Actually, we need to put those on our website, but reputable organizations that you can go to for information. Just be careful that you don't believe everything that you see on the internet, but continue to educate yourself is one thing. The second thing is help to get it into schools in your community. Whether you have school-age children anymore or not, or you never have, if you've heard this today, I hope you know that it's important that we equip and empower our students to protect themselves, right? Yeah. Because they're capable of doing it, but if they don't know what they're looking for and what it looks like, then they can't avoid it. And so you can help get it into the schools. We have a curriculum that's been out there for many years now, since 2011. It's gotten into 21 states so far and counting, but we still have plenty of schools to get it into in Virginia. So if you want to learn more about that, you can go to prevention-project.org and you can see all of that. You can, you know, if you've got ins at the school with teachers, superintendents, school board, write letters to your school board, just let them know it's here. It was built in Virginia, and it needs to be in all the schools. There are some different laws on the books about what needs to be happening in our schools. Yeah. And so, but it's kind of sometimes up to us as the community to make sure that that is happening. So I'd encourage you to do that. We are starting to also work with college age students and create a blueprint and a toolkit for college age kids. So just continue to come back and visit our site. You'll find more, I'm sure.
That's
and then on the survivor side of things, I just encourage you to, and by the way, even if a school or you don't want to choose to use a prevention project, use something. Like, just don't not do anything. So that's the prevention side. And then the survivor side, there are more, you know, more and more nonprofits, but just make sure you're the nonprofit that you're reaching out to or learning about, that it's legitimate. You know, you can go and look it up online and make sure it's a register with the IRS as a 501c3. Make sure you know who the board is, what their mission is, what they do, that they're a very transparent organization, and then see where they need help. There are organizations doing some work on this issue in, you know, in all of the major communities in Virginia, for sure. Hampton Roads, Richmond, and Northern Virginia. So you can easily find some friends in those places. You can also, you know, if you're somebody who just wants to advocate for the legislation, there's a lot of people working on that. And, you know, you can talk to your local representatives about that. And then if you just have, you know, a business, you could become a second chance employer for a survivor, or you can encourage your workplace to, you know, to come alongside nonprofits if they have a foundation, you know, that that's an area that you care about and you want them to be giving, you know, most corporate organizations have a, you know, philanthropic piece to them, however they do it, employer matches or foundations or whatever. Even United Way campaigns, I mean, you can write in any 501c3 nonprofit. So feel free to write in Freekind if you'd like. So anybody who participates in a United Way campaign, you can help in that way. Yeah, there's so many volunteer opportunities, and it just depends on what the organization's doing, what those opportunities are. But again, don't think you have to have any special skills to do it. You can use the skills that you have to make a difference.
Tell me a little bit, it's a shifting gears just a little bit, from the perspective of someone now that you've been in this content and in this world for a while, how do you, you know, there's this context, I was just talking to somebody the other day about compassion fatigue, and when you're in a world where you're seeing a lot of harshness and a lot of darkness, and you're somebody that's trying to help, and this is just, I think it's a nice opportunity to talk to you about it. In terms of, I'm sure, as people listen, we've got a lot of healthcare professionals, mental health professionals, like it's real in terms of when you're in a position where your primary goal is to serve others in this capacity, in some capacity, maybe not exactly the same. So for you personally, what are some of the things that you do to stay ahead of that, make sure that you're staying mentally healthy, right? Like, what are some of your practices so that it doesn't get the better of you, because it's pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, you're not wrong. It's heavy for everyone on the team, especially for those on the front line. So the ones that are working directly with survivors day in and day out, hearing in detail their stories. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's one of the things that you know, I lose sleep on a regular basis, of like, how do I keep my team healthy? Because that's extremely important to me. And I don't want them to burn out, and I don't want them to become unhealthy as a result of doing this work.
Yeah.
So we're very intentional as an organization about that. In fact, just this past year, I had a guy come in who he happens to be a multivocational pastor, has all these degrees in trauma and resiliency. And I had been working with him on some things, but I said, I would like you to come in and do like a really in-depth work with our team. And it was called, that course was called Trauma Responsive Care and Practice. And it was incredible. It's an organization called 3E Restoration that he helped to start. And it is it gives you really practical tools. This is not trauma-informed, which you'll hear that term a lot. Trauma-informed is not enough. I can be informed about a lot of things and it's not going to, you know, if unless I do something with them, it doesn't change anything. So being trauma responsive is a huge piece for us, but not just with our clients, that's with each other too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with our team, it's just about how we check in on each other, how we support each other, how we cover for each other. It's about how I am aware if we have a client who, unfortunately, and this does happen in our work, you know, sometimes will pass away. And, you know, we have to stop and grieve through that. You know, it ends up being an individual for the person who is closest to them, but a collective grieving process for, you know, for our time having the honor to be a part of that person's life. And, you know, we're a small nonprofit, but we do offer health insurance because there's no way I could ask somebody to come and do this work and have them not be covered by health insurance. That's just crazy. We try to tap into anything in our community that offers, like during COVID, there was an agency that was offering free mental health care for nonprofits, for the people that worked in them and their families. I mean, incredible, right? Bringing in, you know, specialists, doing, having, you know, we have some dedicated fun time every quarter and different people, you know, we just rotate who picks what we're going to do. And it could be anything from goat yoga to, you know, Top Golf to whatever. I mean, we celebrate, you know, birthdays and holidays and other things together. And we just try to, you know, get time out and then just encouraging people to take those breaks that they have.
Yeah.
We learned all kinds of mindfulness practices in that too. And, you know, it's not like you have to go out somewhere and do yoga or meditation. I mean, there are things you can do sitting right at your desk that are grounding exercises and things like that. So we, you know, sometimes we have to remind each other to use them, but they really do make a difference. So those are all, you know, all things that I do personally and I do with my team because it's so, so important in this work.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I love the specificity. I think it translates to compassion fatigue. It also translates to people that are burnt out and need to like that rest and recovery. I feel like it's such an important part of being able to do anything well, you know, in terms of whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish in a day. Let's talk a little bit about the intersection of soft skills, just from the perspective of someone who's been in healthcare. So you've had the corporate experience and the administration side. You've now had, you know, the work that you're doing in this space. I'm curious, you know, a way to maybe ask this question of you is just what's the skill set that you think when you think about the soft skills, is it different in one or the other in terms of what helps people to be successful? Is there one that like translates no matter what you're doing from your perspective in terms of helping people to have impact and be successful?
You know, I had a few things that I was thinking of when you initially invited me that are general ones. But as we've had this conversation, one of the things that I think is super important is self-awareness.
Yeah.
Really being intentional at wherever you are in your life about figuring out how to be self-aware, because there's nothing worse in a workplace, in friendship, in a marriage, than being so blind to the things that have shaped and impacted your life for good and for bad, and how you land with others. Certainly in this work, you have to be so aware of that. So one of the things in this work is that often, and I think my mental health professionals and my healthcare people out there will relate to this, people who are drawn to that kind of helping work often have something that they're dragging with them, right? There's something that has driven you to do that. And sometimes they're not healthy enough to help somebody else. They haven't dealt with their own stuff, but they want to help somebody else with their stuff. That's not so helpful. So, you know, it's hard work to do, to be self-reflective and to consider the things, again, that have happened in your life for good and for bad. They all shape us. They can all be used for good. I do believe that. In fact, one of the things I've realized, even though I've been on that journey for a long time at this stage in my life, as a woman who grew up in the time that I did and then getting into this work, I had never said it out loud, but you know, I am a survivor of sexual assault, not of trafficking, but of sexual assault. and on two different occasions and by people that I knew. And I would have never called it that. I would have never thought of myself as a victim. And quite likely, I didn't get all the support that I needed to figure that out sooner, which would have been really helpful for me, right? So I just really encourage people to consider, and I'm such a big fan of therapists. I think everybody should have one. This life is not easy. So we do need to be in community, and we do need somebody who can be objective and talk to us about kind of process through things and give us some tools in our toolkit to work. But being self-aware is so important, no matter what field you go into, so that you know what drives you, what motivates you, what triggers you, and you can be a little bit more in control of those things, but also not be afraid to share a little bit, not overshare, because there is that. But the importance of, you know, everything we do, I think, in this world, and certainly in this work, is relational. We are an organization who, some organizations out there, sorry, government, but a lot of government entities can force you to be transactional, right? Yeah. I do this for you and go on your way. In the work that we do, we really think of this as a continuum, and we're going to be there as long as you need us. Some need us more than others. And we don't want to create dependencies. We work hard not to do that. But we do want to stay with people for the journey, because it's not linear and it's not short. And that's true in our lives too. And then in the nonprofit world, you're constantly needing to raise funds for what you do. You can't just show up on somebody's door and ask them for money, and that's the only time they see you. You know, you're building relationships. You're trying to get to know them and what they care about and figure out if that aligns. And sometimes that's not, and that's okay. But that's a, you know, just that self-awareness and that building of relationships is going to be the key to success, in my opinion, no matter what.
I love the comments on self-awareness. And it's so interesting, because as I've evolved in my business, and as I've worked with teams and companies, and then also coaching, individual coaching, this idea of, you know, who am I in this scenario? And how do I operate, and do I want to operate differently? It's really the core of any sort of training or coaching or change. And so this engagement around really understanding and having a personal interest to know that. And the thing I'll say too, that because I know you, that I think is important, you know, one of the passions for me about this podcast is helping people hear other people's story of change and pivot and challenge. And, you know, we didn't touch on, you know, from, you know, you mentioned something very personal to you that's happened, but I also know generally other things that you've had to survive in terms of difficulty and resilience. And to know, to hear you talk about something so passionately, to see you engaged in something in a way where you're making such an impact, and to, I think for me, it's just a great illustration that no matter who you are, what you go through, If you have an interest to grow, if you have an interest to find kind of that purpose, or to be, we talk a lot about, you know, like career stuff on here. So it's like that intersection of, you know, passion and purpose and doing a thing. And I just feel like you're such a good example of someone, you know, like you've always been like a really positive and fun person to hang out with, and you're like, you know, great conversationalist, and we've had good therapeutic talks and all of that, but you're also someone that's been through a lot. So it's just, I think it's a very powerful thing to show, you know, there is a lot of opportunities if you choose to seize them and figure out how to do it. And you've given a lot of examples here on how to do that. And then I think, you know, for those interpersonal people, you know, interpersonally for people that are like at this juncture or at an intersection point, know that there's opportunity if you want to do the work, if you can kind of take a minute and look at where you are and look at what you've been through and how that can serve you in your future. So I just want to take a moment, and as someone who knows you, to kind of recognize that, but also, you know, be able to talk about it in a way that it's like inspirational for other people that might be going through some difficult times, and turning that into something that's really positive.
I appreciate that.
Of course. And then lastly, just maybe because of it, it's a nice little segue in terms of that advice to young Miss Kersey, because you have been through a lot. And if we were to take kind of your 25-year-old self or your 23-year-old self, and you were to kind of put your arm around her and just give her a little bit of guidance, you know, I'm a believer that things happen when they should, and you kind of, you know, it's what makes life life. But is there anything that you would tell her to just kind of soften it a bit, or to help her out a bit, or something you've learned along the way?
Yeah, There are probably a couple things, and I think this might be more typical of our generation. Mm-hmm. For anybody out there who's our generation listening, we were taught to just, you know, suck it up, buttercup, and keep on going, like no matter what it was. And a lot of us were raised with a very intense work ethic. And I remember somebody early in my career giving me this advice. I mean, I can tell you his name. I can tell you where I was sitting when he gave me the advice. And I have carried it with me, but I've constantly had to work on it. And that is, for me personally, I've taken the energy and that kind of upbringing and background. And so anything bad that happens or a struggle or whatever, like, I'm going to push through it. I'm going to fight through it and keep working. So that work, can become your life. Become your identity. And mm-hmm. it's not my identity. I mean, I happen to be a woman of deep faith, and that is my true identity. And that always pulls me out of the times when I try to hang my identity on my work. So don't let your work become your identity. And I've learned too, through the trauma and resiliency work, that this notion of balance, I know this is going to throw some people for a loop, but I don't really like using that word either, because I think that different seasons in life are going to require different things, and it's mm-hmm. always going to look a little more like an amoeba or one of those things I never learned in geometry, where it's, you know, it's pull over here and a pull over here on the different aspects of your life that make you a whole. But to not put so much into your work, like, yes, there's going to be seasons where there's a particular project or client or need that you're going to have to put in the extra time and hours, and you're going to miss a weekend or you're going to miss a fun whatever. Yeah, that's going to happen. But don't forget all the aspects of your life, holistically thinking about what you need for you personally to ground you, to keep you self-reflective, to not let things build up in you without realizing it, to pour into your friends, to pour into your family, you know, your health, mental, physical, emotional. You've got to do those things or you're never going to show up as a whole person in the workplace. You might think you are, and you can play a good game, but it will crash on you at some point. And in my experience, even in the time I've been in this role, I took over this role and from the former executive director, and that was a big shift for the organization. COVID hit. There was, even though I've always cared for nonprofits and been in these big organizations, I had a lot of new things to learn. I had people to manage. Like, there was so much change going on, you know, in my life. And all of a sudden, I had good friends who were able to say, like, I didn't like how that last conversation we had, or this is, you know, how this impacted me. You want to have people who tell you what you don't want to hear around you too.
Yeah.
Don't ever surround yourself with yes people. It is the worst possible thing you could do. I've learned so much from my friends who are willing to say hard things sometimes to me, because it can snap you out of it. We can't see our own stuff as easily.
Yeah.
But the older you get and the more you allow yourself to do that, the better person you become. I mean, honestly.
Yeah. And it's something you said, it just struck me because I just had a conversation with one of my sisters who stayed home with her kids for a long time, most of her life. And, you know, I think about it in terms of the diversity in your life and diversity of friendship, work, faith, community, fun, you know, all those different dimensions of one's life. When you think about a financial advisor and they talk about diversity in your portfolio and how important that is, it is the same when you talk about your life. And for those of us, I agree with you that, and maybe it's a certain type of us, so I don't know that it's every female in our generation, but there seems, and maybe we're all friends because we gravitated to each other, this idea of work and identity. And I think, you know, keeping a broader aperture of all those elements, and you shortchange any of them, and mm-hmm. then that one thing becomes so important that if you lose that thing, everything mm-hmm. else falls apart, seemingly. And so I think the power of that diversity, to your point of, you know, while it, because it is a drug like anything else, mm-hmm. the workaholic thing, and it can feel so euphoric when you're doing it well and you're getting a lot of validation and you're getting the promotions, and it's just such a great feeling. And that's why I think a lot of us becomes so important, that identity. But to your point, economy, a different leader gets in a job that doesn't have the same feelings about you as someone else. Like, there's so many things that are out of your control that can kind of, that thing can fall apart. Mm-hmm. That then it's like, oh my gosh, where's the rest of it? So mm-hmm. I feel like it's such good advice. And I similarly, I think it's like, it's good counsel, not just for younger me, but for like current me, to remember that those things need care and feeding and love too. Because that does, you're right, it does make you better at the rest of it when you've got that, you've mm-hmm. got some attention in all those different ways. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you happen to be in a profession where, you're helping or it's got this cause to it, mm-hmm. I mean, it is so easy to rationalize, yeah. well, this is more important than, and I'm this higher good and all of this stuff,
yeah.
None of us really were born with a cape on, right? Like, we're great. Most of my friends, including the one I'm talking to right now, I see as Wonder Women in my life. But the truth is, we still are all human, and we do yes. have limitations, and we can't do everything, and we can't make everything exactly right in the world, right? And so, give yourself a little grace yeah. too. That's something I was not good at early on. I was told I give other people grace, but I did not give myself that same grace. And that was like boy, and I blocked that one out, that took me many years in my life to learn. So if anybody's younger, try that earlier.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Because we can do that. Just like we can see other things in other people, we can also be kinder to other people than we are to ourselves. And you're doing a huge disservice to yourself when you don't extend yourself that same kindness.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much. This was fantastic. Thank you, Lisa, for your time and for all the great information you shared. Specific insight that I enjoyed: hearing about what it means to run a nonprofit, your favorite soft skill of self-awareness and the importance it has on all of one's relationships, your openness about being a survivor yourself, and the advice of, if you're one of those suck it up buttercup people and you have a very intense work ethic, careful of work becoming your identity. We're all a lot more than the work that we do. Thank you to Missy for producing this episode and Hannah for your support. Thank you to all of our relatable community for listening. Take a moment and check out our On the Go series on YouTube. You can see video portions of several interviews. We condense many of these to include the most important advice and insight. And the best part, they're only 15 minutes or less. Until next time, this is Teresa Freeman with Relatable. Stay connected.